Beginning second half of the February 13 show, there should be no continuity problem for the listener. These are comments I'm making to help myself and others who are airing this program understand that I've had to submit it in two halves. Hopefully we won't have this scary problem of at least a part of the recording program seeming to freeze up on me. Okay, continuing now. Chapter 14 of The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, The Next Generation. A little bit of a slight rehash here. It was a sunny December afternoon when I sat out on the balcony waiting for Mazen. The office is located on a hill, so I had a full view of the occupation. Israeli military vehicles, covered in protective wiring, drove fast and nervously with their blue lights flashing. I could hear the loudspeakers from the army base nearby and police sirens in the distance. And I could hear the sound of new homes going up in the Israeli settlement of Har Gilo. Mazen arrived a few minutes after I did. I spent most of the afternoon sitting on the porch talking with him. He had set up a visit to the Dahesha refugee camp for me, and I was going to teach karate there over the next few days. Mazen is energetic, and he knows how to get things organized. Sitting on the porch, while he lit one cigarette with another and I sipped Arabic coffee, we went from small talk to politics, and then to his story and the story of his family. His older brothers had participated in the First Intifada and sat in jail. They are all principled men who hold respectable positions. Mazen himself belonged to the PFLP, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and had been arrested by Israel for that reason, for his membership in it. He told me of the torture and beatings he endured during his interrogation. And then he said, "What kept me from breaking during the interrogation and torture was the knowledge that, like my brothers before me, it would be known that I did not break during the interrogations and I did not talk," end quote. He lit another cigarette, cursed in Arabic, and then said, "Not a night goes by without nightmares from the torture I received at the hands of the Israelis." Mazen's father, Ali Faraj, 62, was killed in April 2002 during the Second Intifada. He went out to buy food for the family, and while he was gone, the Israeli authorities imposed a curfew on the camp. Being gone from the camp, he didn't realize the curfew was in effect, and when he returned, an Israeli tank fired at him and killed him. Then the Israeli authorities immediately arrested Mazen and kept him under administrative detention for several months. He was targeted because he was the youngest of all his brothers and the only one who was not yet married. Therefore, it was presumed he posed a threat and might try to take revenge. It was soon time for lunch, and the two of us drove to his house in Dahesh. This was my first visit to any refugee camp. In the decades since it was established, Dahesh has become a bustling, disorganized, and overcrowded little town. Its 13,000 residents live on one quarter of a square mile. 13,000 people. All of them are either from or are descendants of people who are from villages around Jerusalem that were destroyed when Israel was established. The villages around the big city of Jerusalem were destroyed. Black and white picture of my friend Mazen Faraj on the right with Eitan, the author's son, at Dahesh refugee camp. Big boy he is. Continuing now with the book. We had lunch and coffee at Mazen's house with his wife and two daughters. Parenthetically, I later brought Eitan with me to visit them as well. And then Mazen took me to the Phoenix House, or El Fenik, a spacious community center that offers kids in Dahesh free after-school activities and camps when school is out. Young college kids who volunteer conduct the activities. Since there are no parks or playgrounds and no swimming pool, putting together activities for kids takes creativity and a lot of dedication. The volunteers I met there, young men and women, had both. "Why is there no pool?" I asked one of the volunteers who showed me around the center. "We have no water." I did not understand. She said, "All the water supply is controlled by Israel, and sometimes the authorities shut the water supply and the camp goes for days without water. You cannot have a pool when you don't even have enough water to drink and wash," end quote. And then he smiled. "But we have a very nice gym where we can have the karate class. For karate to work, you need the right environment, a dojo, a place dedicated to training the mind and body. There is no dojo in Dahesh, so I too had to be creative, and I created one in the gym at El Finique. Using both my limited Arabic and some assistance, I told the children that they need to remove their shoes and socks before the lesson began. They did remove their shoes, but as children usually do, they threw them all over the place. Then rather than begin the class, I asked them to come with me. I removed my shoes and placed them neatly against the wall. I told them that where my shoes go may seem like a trivial thing, but it creates an atmosphere of attention to detail and order, and that brings comfort and calm to the class. I added, and keeping the dojo tidy is an important part of karate. Once the shoes were in place, I assembled the children and proceeded to introduce myself and ask them their names and ages. Then I told them that the first thing we learn in karate is respect, itiram. In karate, respect for others as well as for ourselves is of the utmost importance. That is why we bow, listen to one another, and use our heads and our words to resolve conflicts and solve problems. As I was saying this, I couldn't help thinking of the irony in saying this to people who live under an occupying power that respects none of these things. Then we began the lesson. As the children lined up, I explained how to stand. And as I was explaining, a girl who had practiced karate before called out the names of the different positions in Japanese. Musubidachi, she said softly, revealing that she knew the term for standing with our feet together. Musubidachi. Then I showed them how to kneel down. Siza, she said this time. She knew how to execute the moves and knew the commands of the various techniques in Japanese. It was good to have her there, and she was a great little helper for me and for the class. An hour had gone by quickly, but it was getting late in the day and dark outside, so we had to wrap things up. I promised we would start earlier the next day. When I arrived the next afternoon, I saw a long row of neatly placed shoes in the corridor by the gym. More than 35 kids sat quietly on their knees in Siza. Siza, the kneel-down position that I read about earlier. They were ready and they had taken in what I had previously taught them. The volunteers were visibly proud of the kids, and so was I. Half the class had been there the previous day, and the other half was there for the first time. I welcomed all the new students, and I asked those who were there for the first lesson to share with the others what we had talked about. "Never smoke, it gives you cancer," was the first comment. "Don't hit others and avoid getting hit yourself," was the next comment. "Be respectful to yourself and people around you. Do your best and do not give up when things are hard." On and on they went. I was in a daze. These little guys really internalized the lessons and were able to recall them accurately. Reader's note here, in case there's any confusion, or if anyone is joining the broadcast at this point, I remind everyone we have an Israeli-born Jewish karate teacher teaching mostly Muslim Palestinian children. Let's continue. I noticed a pile of small exercise mats in a corner of the gym, and I knew exactly how we would end the class that day. There is nothing kids love more than to wrestle. I had them do lots of running and relays and then sat them down and explained how all fighting in karate is done, and wrestling especially. We begin with itiram, respect, which in karate is expressed by bowing before and after each match. I made a point of demonstrating how even a student who is a lot smaller than I can take me down. I use Kusai, a particularly talented and serious 11-year-old, who came to every session. Knowing how to use your strength against a larger, seemingly stronger opponent is a big part of karate training, I told them. This also applies when one is fighting to resist a larger and more powerful occupying power. And I made sure that this point did not get lost on the students and volunteers. While there is an aspect of karate that exhibits conformity, in reality, the history of karate is filled with defiance and rebellion. Karate is about beating the odds and developing an independent spirit. I wanted to share that sense of defiance with these kids. Not that they needed my help, because they could be plenty defiant on their own, but to help channel that energy and demonstrate that the relative normality in which they exist is in fact not normal, and that they should not be afraid to rebel in a responsible, nonviolent manner. Before continuing on to the subsection, I'll point out that there is a photograph here of karate wrestling in Dahesh. Obviously, it might occur to people, probably occurs to people, that this is silly and even a waste of time for me to point out every little picture. I think I might have skipped one or two in the course of this book, since you can't see them. But I figure at the very least, first of all, I can point out the fact that there are photographs in this book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine by Miko Peled. And there might be something important in the caption. In this case, the caption simply reads, Karate Wrestling in Dahesh. Looks to me like any other typical gymnasium or at least small gymnastics studio. Okay, new subsection here. When I was done teaching, Mazen picked me up and I returned to the forum office. From there, Khaled drove me to his house in Beit Umar, where I would be spending the next 5 days. Khaled, wearing a dark suit and a serious expression, as always, had clearly not eaten all day, this being Ramadan, distracted by a million and one things. He drove through dirt roads and narrow alleys, because most of the wide paved roads are off limits to Palestinians. I watched him as he absentmindedly sucked on one cigarette after another. I have noticed that Khaled doesn't just smoke cigarettes. He chews on the filter for a while and then inhales deeply like a man hungry for air. Then he blows out the smoke that has been thinned out because he's absorbed so much of it. He chain smokes as though sucking in the freedom denied to him by the Israeli invasion into his life, his family, and his country. I'm going to read that again just for perhaps meaningful aesthetic purposes. He chain smokes as though sucking in the freedom denied to him by the Israeli invasion into his life, his family, and his country. Living in the West Bank among Palestinian friends, I began to realize that the Palestinian suffering goes on no matter how dedicated they are to peace and reconciliation. Dedication to reconciliation and willingness to reach out does not provide Palestinians immunity from the daily struggles with Israeli soldiers, the humiliation, or the cold, discriminatory administration of Israel's occupation regime. In Khaled's case, if not for sheer luck or the grace of God, on November 2004, he would have lost yet another family member to Israeli violence, his son, Moed. It happened 2 days after Yasser Arafat died. That was the day Arafat's funeral took place in Ramallah, and smaller ceremonies and observances were held all over the West Bank for those who couldn't make it to Ramallah. It was a solemn day for Palestinians and many others around the world. The Israeli army was supposed to keep a low profile and allow Palestinians to mourn the death of their leader. But in Beit Umar, soldiers in an army jeep decided to go screeching through town. Residents were leading a peaceful procession of mourning and a symbolic funeral, as one may expect, the jeep's presence ignited the atmosphere. A few young people threw stones at the jeep, and the soldiers responded by firing live ammunition. The result was two casualties, Jameer Omar, a 19-year-old student who was killed immediately, and Muayyad Abu Awad, Khalid's 15-year-old son, who was shot by 5.56 caliber bullet to the hip. Muayyad lay on the ground bleeding badly, and the soldiers stood around him, preventing an ambulance from evacuating him. Khalid was in northern Israel at the time, in a room full of Israeli high school students. He and an Israeli member of the Bereaved Families Forum were there to speak about reconciliation. They explained that the cycle of violence has cost too many lives on both sides and must be stopped, and that real dialogue should take place. Suddenly, they were called outside the room and informed that soldiers had shot Muayyad. The presentation ended abruptly, and as they turned to leave, Khalid stopped at the door. He turned to the students, who remained shocked in their seats. He said, "Whatever happens, even if the worst happens, even if I have lost my son, we must never lose hope. We must never stray from the path of reconciliation." Back in Beit Umar, Muayyad looked like he would soon bleed to death, and his friends decided to evacuate him under fire. A few guys distracted the soldiers by hurling stones, and as the soldiers chased them, others managed to get Muayyad into the ambulance that took him to the hospital in Hebron, some 10 miles away. By the time he arrived, his condition was too severe, and the doctors in Hebron were not able to help him. When word got out that Khalid's son was injured, people at the office of the Bereaved Families Forum in Israel began searching for someone who could help save the boy's life. In what turned out to be a joint Israeli-Palestinian effort, Muayyad was transported to an Israeli ambulance that took him to Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, where adequate facilities and the best-trained doctors could treat him. On the way, Israeli army medics tried to stabilize his condition. But by the time they reached the hospital, his blood pressure was zero. Muayyad was rushed into the operating room just as Khalid, breathless and sick with worry, arrived. At last, close to midnight, after long hours, the doctor came out of the operating room. He said, had he arrived 10 minutes later, he would have died. Thank goodness we were able to save him and save his leg. Many Israeli and Palestinian friends came to the hospital to be with Khalid and Muayyad during the difficult weeks of Muayyad's recovery and rehabilitation. I called several times from the U.S. and spoke to Khalid, and I was relieved to hear that the worst was over. None of this has provided Khalid and his family immunity. In January of 2010, Israeli soldiers came to Khalid's house in Beit Umar at 2 in the morning, banged on the door, and threatened to blow up the house if the family didn't open up immediately. They then threw everyone out of the house, including young and terrified children. They ransacked the house, leaving a trail of destruction. When they emerged, the soldiers singled out Muhammad, Muayyad's twin brother, and took him away. After spending 12 months in prison without being charged, Muhammad was finally tried and sentenced to a total of 2 years in an Israeli prison. Meanwhile, Khalid's entire family was denied entry into Israel and thus prevented from visiting Muhammad. And another reader's reminder here, these are the words of an Israeli-born, Jerusalem-Israeli-born Jewish man, the author of this book, Miko Peled. And a reminder, too, that so many Israelis and American Jewish people would read or hear these words and would instantly, in knee-jerk fashion, toss this man off as a self-hating Jew who was only out to destroy Israel. But what of his testimony? What of his witness? An Israeli Jew is reporting these things. Is he by necessity a liar, a saboteur, a man who is treasonous to the cause of true Judaism? All right. So much for my commentary. I tried to keep it short. It was indeed my own commentary based on what I read out of the book. What you heard me say was not written in the book. In the new subsection, let's continue with this chapter, which is almost over. Two more pages. Over the years, Bassam Aramin, father of 10-year-old Abir, who was shot by an Israeli soldier, became known for his dedication to reconciliation and his relentless activism for Palestinian freedom. He coined the term Palestinian bar mitzvah to describe the horror most young Palestinians have to endure at the hands of the Israeli soldiers. Footnote to that expression, Palestinian bar mitzvah here, bar mitzvah. Bassam Aramin, this was taken from author Bassam Aramin, who we're talking about, the Palestinian bar mitzvah, Electronic Intifada, July 21, 2008. Go to electronicintifada.net. Hopefully you'll be able to navigate through to find that full story. Continuing now with the book. He wrote an article with the same title after the Israeli army put his son Arab, A-R-A-B, through a real-life nightmare. This nightmare, Bassam later wrote, which took place less than 2 years after his daughter Abir was killed, is the daily bread, the rite of passage of every Palestinian boy. Hence the connection to bar mitzvah. Continuing, it happened on a Friday in July 2008 when Bassam's older son Arab, 14 at the time, asked to go on a rare excursion with friends to the Sea of Galilee in the north. For days he had begged Bassam to let him go. At first, Bassam refused, insisting that he was too young to be traveling so far from home without his parents. But finally, he gave his permission on the condition that Arab would remain in constant phone contact with him throughout the day. Arab traveled by bus with about 45 people, mostly teenagers and families with children, all of them legal residents of Israel, of the nation of Israel. Arab called to check in after the bus was underway, and everything was going fine. The day was a huge success and around 11 o'clock that night, Arab called to say that they would be home in half an hour. When an hour later they had not returned, Bassam became worried and he called, wondering why they were late. "There are a lot of soldiers here," Arab whispered into the phone. "The police stopped the bus, we don't know why, and we're in Jerusalem. The soldiers are telling us not to talk on the phone. I'll call back later." Bassam later described the situation in his article. Quote, "In the industrial neighborhood of Wadi al-Jouz in Jerusalem, Israeli troops on motorcycles, along with police and army units, were stationed on the path the bus was taking from Tiberias back home to Anata. When the bus drove by, the soldiers demanded that the driver stop." Arab later said to his father, "At that moment, all I could think of was Abir. We are from national security," the soldiers told the passengers, and they ordered the young men, about 10 of them, to begin taking off their clothes in the bus in front of the women and girls. Then they took these young men off the bus, one by one, and had them lie down on the ground, which was littered with stones and broken glass. This puzzled Arab, and later he asked his father about it. "How can they ask the men to undress in front of the women? Don't they have morals?" Bassam explained, humiliation by forced nakedness didn't just happen to your friends. It is a method used by the Israeli military. When we were in their prison without any way to defend ourselves, our guards would take sadistic pleasure in seeing us naked, in humiliating us." Arab, being smaller and younger than the other boys, stayed on the bus with the women and children. Then a female soldier got on the bus and demanded, "Bring the dog!" At that point, another soldier boarded the bus with an attack dog and began terrorizing everyone. It was hours later when Arab was finally able to again communicate with Bassam, who later said, "There are no words for the state I was in during those hours, waiting for his next call and dreading it would not come." Then at 2:30 a.m., a call came. "We are at the Moscow BA, Arab told his father, referring to the main police detention center located by the Russian compound in Jerusalem. Why are you being detained? They didn't tell us anything. Go up to the soldier and tell him, you have to talk to my father. He does not know where I am. End quote. Arab replied that he was scared to do so. They'd already beaten many of the kids there because they had talked, and talking was not allowed. I guess this is his father talking. You are a brave boy. You shouldn't be scared of the soldier. Talk to him in Hebrew. Over the phone, Bassam could hear Arab go up to the soldier and say, please, can you talk to my father? But the soldier told him to shut his mouth and hung up the phone. He said, if your father wants to see you, tell him to come here. Bassam was beside himself, yelling as loud as he could. You murderers! Where is my son? Do you want to kill him like you killed his sister? Bassam told Arab to turn on the speakerphone so the soldier can hear what he was saying. Dad, don't be afraid. I am okay. They are going to let us go in a bit, like they said. I'll talk with you soon. And he hung up. The soldiers finally let the group go at 3 a.m. Arab arrived home 40 minutes later, exhausted, but alive and uninjured. After telling his father the entire story, Arab then asked for something Bassam found very surprising. I want you to take me with you when you go to one of your lectures in Israel so I can tell the Israelis about the practices of their soldiers on that night. Are you serious? Arab has always questioned Bassam's willingness to talk with Israelis. But he insisted, they have to know what happened so the parents of those soldiers can forbid their children to act that way toward women and children. When I learned of what happened to Arab, I felt a need to relay the entire story to Gila and the children. I couldn't let my children grow up oblivious to the fact that this kind of injustice is taking place. So, during our Friday night family dinner, I told them about this, and soon we were all crying. Eitan and Doron, who loved Bassam dearly, were speechless, and so was I. Israel has tested men like Khaled, Bassam, and Mazen, and thousands of others, and still they are dedicated to reconciliation. The experiences they have suffered at the hands of Israel are not unusual, but rather typical stories of the Palestinians I have met. Yet they do not allow the actions of the Israeli military to get in the way of their important work. I have returned several times to teach karate in Anata, Ramallah, and Dahesh refugee camp, and each time, as I look at the children and youth that come to my class, I have a better appreciation for who they are and what they have to go through just in order to survive. The pain I feel when I leave them and travel freely around the country, that is at least as much theirs as it is mine, if not more, only grows stronger with each visit. End of the chapter. Two more to go in this remarkable book. Remarkable, to say the very least, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Another musical break.
Thank you.
All right, my folks, my friends, radio listeners, loyal listeners to my program, I feel that I've probably stepped away here for too long. It looks as though the program may have repeated itself. It's really hard to, I have a very tight schedule, and in addition to doing this program, I have to do things of utmost importance, like feeding myself. This is the Mideast Migraine Show, which comes to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming online at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. Please visit our website and do consider donating even a few bucks. It really does make a difference, and it ties you to the wonderful work that we're doing here. Free Radio Santa Cruz is an unlicensed radio service, an ongoing expression of nonviolent civil disobedience, which in that very process escapes the clutches of corporate and media dictates over what kind of things should go out on the air or online. That's what's meant by pirate radio, by free radio, truly grassroots community underground radio, and that's what we're about. So that's why we ask you to donate. Go to our webpage at freak, radio.org, freakradio.org. Click on the donate link and on any of the other links that you wish to acquaint yourselves with this wonderful service. Now in our 21st year of operation, longer than any other free radio service in the whole state of California. We're still going, even without a studio. Isn't that remarkable? Click on our schedule, too, get an idea of what we have to offer. For the longest time, and admittedly, this was a rather pathetic state of affairs, we were not doing a very good job of maintaining the daily schedule according to what's up on our website up until the local programs that were more than likely going on in mid and late afternoon, from mid afternoon on into the evening. But now we are taking special care to make sure we figured out how to do this online in true communal fashion. We're making sure that what it says on the schedule is what you're getting on your end of the listening spectrum. Okay, enough for my dribbly dribble. Let's get back to the book. Don't forget, you can make comments, even if this is your first time hearing the program, your first exposure, or not necessarily your first exposure to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Please send a message to MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@g as in gigantic, m as in minuscule, x as in xyz.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Okay, two chapters to go in this book. I tend to doubt that I'll be able to finish the whole book, but let's get through this chapter. Chapter 15, Abu Ali Shaheen. And the book is entitled The General Sojourning of an Israeli in Palestine by Jerusalem-born Israeli Jew Miko Pellet. Abu Ali Shaheen. What made your father change? People constantly ask me what it was that made Mati Peled change from a general who was known for his hawkish views and demanded war in no uncertain terms, to a man determined and dedicated to achieving peace. His insistence that Israel act decisively against Egypt in 1967 and his call for a preemptive strike were part of his legacy. And his harsh words to the hesitant prime minister in the meeting just prior to the war were never forgotten. But his dedication to peace and reconciliation and his dovish opinions in the late part of his life make it hard to believe that during his military service he contributed significantly to Israel's military buildup, and indeed in those years he was no liberal dove. My father had his own way of answering that question in interviews and articles. Quote, when Israel's strategic objectives called for war, I supported the war, and when peace was possible, I called for peace, he used to say calmly, and then add, there is no conflict here whatsoever. It was a rational response befitting him. It never occurred to me, nor did I ever have reason to believe, that there was one decisive moment or event that affected him enough to change his thinking. He was not like that, affected by emotion. That's what I thought, at least. So as far as I or the rest of the family was concerned, there was no need to investigate the issue further or dig deeper to look for his motives. The weekend after my first stay at the Haitian refugee camp to teach karate, I called Jamal to see if he was free the following week. He said there was someone he wanted me to meet in person. A man named Abu Ali Shaheen. His friend said, he is the man who created the order that guided our life in prison. He was our leader, and he has a lot of respect for your father. In fact, he visited your father's grave several times, and he wants to meet you, end quote. The name didn't mean anything to me, but I was curious to learn about this man. So the next day I took the bus from East Jerusalem to Ramallah, where I met Jamal. We drove together to pick up a few friends of his, all men who had spent years in Israeli prisons, each with a story that could fill volume. We arrived at a spacious apartment building in Ramallah, where a diminutive old man with white hair, glasses, and a white beard welcomed us at the door with hugs and kisses, and then invited us into his study. I asked if it was all right for me to film him. I was not sure what he was going to say, but I had a sense it was important, so I wanted to record it. He said it was fine and walked out of the room. When he returned, he had a checkered black and white keffiyeh, the symbol of Fatah, slung over his shoulder. This was Abu Ali Shaheen, Fatah commander and leader of the Palestinian political prisoners for more than two decades. And there is a black and white picture of Abu Ali Shaheen, Fatah commander and leader, as I just stated here. Continuing with the text. He said with a smile, this is the first time I am speaking in Hebrew since 1982. And thus began a long, captivating story from a man who at one time was one of Yasser Arafat's closest assistants and on Israel's most wanted list. But more than that, he knew something about my father that I had never heard before. He began, in 1948, during the war, my father was killed. I later learned that Abu Ali was born in January 1939, so he was not yet 10 when this occurred. Abu Ali continued here, he commanded the forces that defended our village, Beshit, and he was killed in the battle. After the battle, our village was destroyed and we ended up at Rafah refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. My father was killed in battle, but war is war. You expect that a man may be killed. But in 1967, just days after the end of the Six-Day War, the Israelis massacred my entire family, killing citizens, not fighters, end quote. Now, there is a footnote here to his mention of his village, Beshit, also known as Beit Shit, or the House of Seth, who was a prominent prophet in the Muslim tradition and the third son of Adam and Eve, according to Jewish tradition. Besht was a village of close to 20,000 between the towns of Yibna and Isdud, today's Yavne and Ashdod. You see, this, of course, is an extremely common phenomenon of the Arabic names of towns being retransliterated into Hebrew. Original names, Yibna and Isdud, today's Yavne and Ashdod. It had a rich history that goes back to the 12th century. The village was destroyed by the Gavati Brigade in 1948. Its residents were deported, and most of them were exiled to the Gaza Strip, where they lived as refugees. Abu Ali stood up from his chair and began to pour coffee for all of us. He stopped and looked at me. "That is how I know your father." I was puzzled. My father had nothing to do with Gaza in 1967. "How was my father involved?" I asked. He said, "I will get to that in a moment. It was no more than a week after the war when an Israeli army officer showed up in our neighborhood at the Rafah refugee camp in Gaza, leading a company of soldiers and a bulldozer. The soldiers told everyone to come out of their homes. The officer inspected everyone and then sent the women and the children who were under 13 years old back home. He took all the men and the boys over 13 to another part of the camp, far enough so the families could not see. Then the soldiers lined up everyone up against a wall and shot all of them. When they were done, the officer went one by one and shot each person in the head." The author, Peled, said, "How many people were there?" "More than 30, among them a 13-year-old boy and an 86-year-old man. After he shot them, the bodies were laid in a row on the ground, and the bulldozer began driving over them, going back and forth until the bodies were unrecognizable." "How did you find out?" "It was in plain view. Many people saw it. They saw the bulldozer and they saw the officer go and shoot each person in the head. There are eyewitness accounts. My mother ran out when the news reached her, and she was the first to see the men and boys who were killed. She could only tell who was who by the clothes they wore." I was barely able to digest all of this, and I still did not see how my father could have been connected to any of it. I asked, "Were you in Gaza then?" "No, I was in the West Bank working undercover. A friend came up to me one day and gave me the bad news. When it was confirmed to me that this really happened, I felt such intense pain that I thought my heart would explode. I knew at that moment that I could never cause anybody to feel such pain. I don't care if someone is Israeli or Jewish or anything at all. This is such pain that no one should ever have to suffer." The atmosphere in the room was growing intense. Abu Ali was sitting comfortably in his chair behind a large desk stacked with books and papers while we were on the edge of our seats. Jamal intervened from time to time to clarify if Abu Ali could not find a word in Hebrew or offer a translation if he asked for one. But it was clear the entire story was new to all of us. The author asks, "Abu Ali, I still don't see how my father was involved." "I am getting to that," was the reply, and he continued, "Then I was caught and I was interrogated and tortured for 5 months. During my interrogation, I said to my interrogator, a guy named Pinhas, 'Why do you say we are killers? You were the murderers, not us. Why kill an 86-year-old man? What could he possibly do to you, or a 13-year-old boy?'" He continued here, "Pinhas took an interest in what I said, and he asked for details. When he came back the next day, he took down the names of the people who were killed. Then one day Pinhas came to see me with another officer and said, 'You see this man? He will make sure someone will look into the massacre of your relatives.'" Abu Ali's response, "Did he actually use the word massacre?" I was dubious, so Abu Ali emphasized, "He used the word massacre." It wasn't until many years later, 1979, that I learned this officer worked with your father, and I learned what your father did. I was at Chota Prison at the time, and I was talking with an officer from the Shabak, which is the Israeli General Security Service, or GSS, Shabak. And he was the first one to tell me that General Peled heard how my family was murdered in Rafah, and he went to see for himself. Later, I had this confirmed by people in Rafah. Mati Peled came to the camp in person. I was hearing all of this for the very first time, and the entire thing physically moved me. I looked around at the bookshelves to ease some of the tension. They were stacked with books and binders, and I remember thinking that this reminded me of the study of a university professor. Clearly, Abu Ali was an intellectual of sorts and had a solid political ideology that was firmly based on principle. But why did my father take such an interest in this particular story? To that, I could find no answer other than it was brought to his attention and he wanted to see with his own eyes what really happened. There was more. Ali continued, "Everyone in Rafah talked about the fact that Mati Paled, one of the greatest officers of the Israeli army, a general that was highly respected, straight as an arrow, the man who was military governor of Gaza, came in person. He even drove himself and visited the homes of the victims. Your father visited my family's home. He spoke to the adults and he consoled the children. People commented how disturbed he was when they took him to see the spot where the massacre took place. Your father also wrote a report to Yitzhak Rabin and Chaim Bar-Lev, but they did nothing." End quote. Abu Ali paused and sipped his coffee. He had transported himself and us with him to that time and place. What I wouldn't give to have been in my father's office when he heard of this and decided to go to Gaza to see for himself. If I could have been beside him as he reached Gaza and began looking around. He spoke Arabic fluently by then, so he did not need the help of an interpreter. He was not naive, and it surely did not surprise him to see that officers and soldiers were capable of atrocities. I remember that in his Gaza report, at the end of his tenure as military governor, he wrote of the lawlessness with which soldiers had conducted themselves before he took command. Quote, "It became known that this changed him from a militant man to a man dedicated to peace. I felt your father was with us, and that washed away the anger in my heart completely. Completely. I had learned to subdue my feelings well enough so as not to show emotion. But this man, this Palestinian commander, hero, and patriot, was talking about my father, General Mati Peled, who, for all practical purposes, was his sworn enemy. In fact, this man was, for many years, close to being enemy number one. This was much more than I had ever heard anyone speak about my father, and it was all said with such respect and regard for him." Abu Ali then looked at Jamal and the other Palestinians and spoke to them in Arabic. When he was done, I said, "Immediately after the war, while still in uniform, my father said that Israel must recognize the rights of the Palestinian people. He said that if we don't do this, the Israeli army would become an occupation army and would resort to brutal means to enforce the Israeli occupation on the Palestinian people." The author continues to speak here. He said this while still in uniform, and he never stopped saying it and advocating for Palestinian rights till he died. Jamal and the others looked at me, and Jamal said, "That is exactly what Abu Ali just said to us in Arabic." I had read about this statement, and I know it was said in a meeting of the IDF general staff right after the war, but now I was wondering whether or not this was after he saw what we saw in Gaza. I read what he said over and over. Quote, "If we keep these lands, popular resistance to the occupation is sure to arise, and Israel's army would be used to quell that resistance with disastrous and demoralizing results." In light of what Abu Ali was telling me, my father's words seem almost prophetic. He was always concerned with the moral fabric of Israeli society and Israeli soldiers, Had he already seen the first signs of brutality and therefore said these things? There was no way for me to find out. We were all silent for several minutes when Ali, Abu Ali's wife, called us for lunch. We were joined by the rest of his family and friends to a feast of lamb meat, which Abu Ali served us with his bare hands, along with rice and yogurt. We ate together, and then sat in his living room with fruit and coffee. I noticed a larger-than-life tapestry of Yasser Arafat hanging on the wall, and next to him portraits of the poet Mahmoud Darwish and Che Guevara. I was tired, but I wanted to know more. I particularly wanted to know more about Abu Ali's experiences in prison. Jamal told me that the life of prisoners, their routines of study and political activities, were established largely by Abu Ali. How does a man denied everything in the world that I take for granted not only survive and function, but also find the inner strength to continue fighting and contributing to the welfare of others? He had built an entire movement that impacted thousands of people. What Jamal told me earlier was also corroborated by Israeli sociologist Dr. Maya Rosenfeld. Here's what he said. The formative nature of the, quote, prison years, in terms of the contribution to the political education and maturation of the individual, is traced back to the process by which Palestinian prisoners succeeded in organizing themselves inside Israeli prisons and building what they referred to as an, quote, internal order, or nitham idachili. Dr. Rosenfeld also writes, it is rare to find a family in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip that has not experienced the incarceration of at least one of its male members. Clearly, this is an issue that defines Palestinian society much more than is otherwise known or appreciated. And this man, with whom I just spent almost an entire day, was behind this order that turned the years in prison that so many young Palestinians had to endure into a meaningful, indeed an educational experience. So, after lunch, I asked Abu Ali to carry on with his story about his life and his work in prison. By the time the Gaza Strip was recaptured by Israel in 1967, Abu Ali Shaheen was commander of the Fatah Southern Command, which included the southern part of the West Bank, Bethlehem and Hebron, and the towns surrounding them, and the Gaza Strip, the Fatah Southern Command. Quote, after the war, Yasser Arafat and I traveled to the West Bank and Gaza together to inspect the Fatah military cells after the 1967 war. We transported arms and moved fighters from Gaza, where they were well trained, to the West Bank, where the fighters had minimal training. End quote. This was unbelievable. Two Palestinian underground military leaders who were on Israel's top 10 most wanted list were traveling in areas that were occupied by the IDF and swarming with Israeli troops. If they went from the West Bank to Gaza, they had to travel through Israel itself. This means that Yasser Arafat, who was still unknown to the world, but not unknown to the Israeli intelligence, managed to infiltrate under some disguise, probably from Jordan, right under the noses of Israeli troops and the Israeli intelligence services, who had also flooded the newly conquered territories. Arafat was then able to somehow travel inside Israel and then enter another occupied territory as he went into the Gaza Strip. Abu Ali went on faster than I could digest. I had no idea there were military cells active at the time and being trained within areas controlled by Israel. I was still trying to get my hands around the fact that I was hearing all this from a Fatah commander. It was pretty heroic stuff, and I had a million questions I wanted to ask him. When were you caught, and how? September 1967. An informant gave me up. I was on the bus traveling from Gaza to Jerusalem. I had my head down on the seat in front of me the entire time as to keep my face hidden. Then, about 5 miles from Jerusalem, the bus was stopped. I still kept my head down, and after a few moments, I felt someone hit me on the head so hard I thought my head would explode. I looked up, and there were Magav, police, border police, and soldiers. I saw the guy who ratted me out standing by an army jeep. Later on, he was killed in Frankfurt. Someone was sent there for that purpose. He continues here, during the interrogations, they nearly killed me. For 5 months, I was kept alone in a small dark cell where they tortured and beat me. There was no latrine, so I had to stand in my own excrement. But I would not cooperate, and I did not talk. After almost 5 months of interrogation, they took me out, washed me with a fire hose, and said, "Clean yourself up, you filthy Arab." They took me to Sarafend, a military base near Tel Aviv, where they placed me in a room by myself. Army Chief of Staff General Rabin, Deputy Chief of Staff General Bar Lev, and Head of Army Intelligence General Yariv came in. End quote. These were the three most powerful men in Israel at the time: Rabin, Bar Lev, and Yariv, all Israeli army generals. Continuing, in the words of Abu Ali, quote, "General Yariv spoke as the others watched. 'So you don't want to talk? Who do you think you are, some kind of hero? Don't you know that we brought down Nasser and his entire army? Do you think we will not bring you down as well?'" End quote. One of Jamal's friends asked if it was all right to light a cigarette, which was a little unusual because in Palestine everyone smokes everywhere and all the time. Neither Jamal nor I smoke, and apparently neither does Abu Ali. Jamal asked him to refrain, but Abu Ali did not mind as long as he opened a window. I can imagine that for a smoker to sit all this time without lighting up was hard, so I didn't mind either. He opened the window a little and lit up. Jamal wanted to break the tension a bit, so he placed his big hand on me and said, "Alanya Miko, welcome Miko." "Alan Fik," I replied. This was all quite surreal. I was an Israeli sitting there among these Palestinians, former resistance fighters, and we were all perfectly fine. Abu Ali stood up, calmly poured us all more Arabic coffee into a tiny cup. Then he continued, "I thought that I would be killed soon, and this may be the only chance to ever speak up. So I looked at these three generals and I said, 'One day when we, the Palestinians, liberate Tel Aviv and you are caught and become my prisoners and you are interrogated, will you talk? Will you give up your friends and your comrades in arms?'" End quote. The author says, "So you didn't talk? Never. It would be a disgrace to talk. I was a commander, and if I talked during interrogations, I would never be able to hold my head up among the other prisoners. Even to this day, I have not talked about what I did, and I did a lot. I have written it all down, and it is being kept somewhere outside of the country. After I die, they can publish what I wrote and learn about the things we did." End quote. I would lie if I said this did not tease my curiosity, but I respected his commitment to silence. "But," he said, and he raised his finger and looked directly at me, "I never gave an order to hurt a civilian, and I never did so myself. Even the prosecutor at my trial said, 'He is the enemy of the Kaki,' Kaki meaning the army. All of my operations, and there were many, were against military targets. As a child, I remember that Fatah was the word to describe the enemy. The way I understood things as a child many years ago, they were the vilest, most frightening, bloodthirsty Jew killers since the Nazis. I was the son of an Israeli general, and here I was sitting with a Fatah commander from the days when I was a child and a few other Fatah commanders who were closer to me in age. Had the conflict been solved and peace reigned, it would have been somewhat romantic to reminisce about the old days. But the conflict was still going on, and so was the resistance. Yet there I was, and there they were, drawn together as though we were now on the same side, hoping for better days. What is the point of harming civilians? Abu Ali asked rhetorically. If you harm the military, you harm the state. If you harm a civilian, what do you achieve? I never acted in vengeance either. Jamal wanted to make sure I understood the point, so he clarified, Abu Ali never avenged the massacre of his family in Rafah. I was reminded of a line from the movie The Interpreter with Nicole Kidman, where she says, vengeance is a lazy form of grief. Quote, when my interrogations began, I weighed 75 kilograms, about 165 pounds. I was in great shape, like an athlete. I used to walk 120 kilometers, close to 75 miles, in a single night with military equipment on my back. At the end of the five-month interrogation, when they finally sent me to jail, I weighed 39 kilograms, about 86 pounds. From 165 pounds to 86 pounds. He continues, they sent me to Ramleh prison, but the prison warden did not want to take me. I was so frail, he was worried that I would die on his hands. They put me in with common criminals. I remember one in particular, Shemaya Angel. End quote. Shemaya Angel was a renowned Israeli crime lord and serial killer. He says here, they thought the Israeli criminals would kill an Arab like me, but that didn't happen. In fact, I developed relationship with all the heads of the gangs inside the prison. We had an agreement on how we would manage the relations between us because we were united in our struggle against the prison authorities. Our communication with the other Palestinian prisoners, those who were held in other prisons around the country, was a vital piece of our struggle. Footnote to that, in violation of international law, Palestinian prisoners are held in various prisons inside Israel, which is outside the occupied West Bank in Gaza. Continuing with the text, when I can find where I was here. Okay, he continues, Abu Ali Shaheen continues, I would write things for the other Fatah prisoners around the country, issues of policy, lectures on history, and other subjects, and the criminals would help me get it out to the other prisons. I wrote in tiny letters on small pieces of paper and then folded them up. Then we would take a thin piece of plastic and wrap it around the paper tightly. The plastic would then be sealed with heat so it was completely waterproof, and then someone would either swallow it or insert it in their anus and carry it when they were transferred to other prisons. Once the paper reached the other prisons, Fatah prisoners would receive what I wrote, copy it onto a large piece of paper, and read it to the others. End quote. All of this was done by cooperation between Abu Ali and criminal, not political, Israeli prisoners. We even had a constitution, Jamal interjected. The world is told that Palestinians are incapable of governing themselves, but these men took the time and trouble to create a constitution while living in prison under harsh conditions that turn even the finest men into animals. I asked him, Abu Ali, did you write the constitution? No, the prisoners' constitution and policies were decided through democratic elections. We communicated with all the prisoners in all the prisons around the country. Abu Ali obviously saw the value of democratic processes, and this again under conditions that were impossible. He mobilized and empowered people to take action and to effect change so that their voices would be heard. In the early days, the, quote, security prisoners had to fight and negotiate for the most basic rights like beds and covers, decent food, and clean water. Nothing was given to them without a fight, and he created the order that facilitated this, and he did it while instilling democratic values in these young men who were overwhelmed, overpowered, and incarcerated with no law and no governments to protect them or care for them. In the sentence here that Miko puts in all the way in italics. Why were we demonizing these people? Why do we fear them when we should embrace them? Israelis like to say that if we were fortunate enough to have a civilized people as our neighbors, say like the Swiss, then things would be different and we could have peace. But I was being exposed to a side of the Palestinians that was truly heroic. And I could see no reason why we can't share this land in peace, and indeed perhaps even share a state with a nation that can produce such principled heroism under the harshest conditions. Abu Ali went on, "That is also the way lessons were distributed and then taught. I wrote books on the history of guerrilla movements and revolutions like Vietnam and Cuba and Cambodia, the history of Zionism and America, the Algerian struggle for independence, and so on." He picked up a cigarette filter from an ashtray and showed it to me. He said, "An entire book was no larger than this." He went on, "When I was in Shatta prison, a maximum security prison in northern Israel near Kibbutz Beit Hashita, I was in the X sections, in solitary confinement for 12 years. But still my brain seems to be okay." He laughed. He continued, But there I was on one side and a prison guard on the other. He too was a prisoner sitting alone in a small yard. After all, he was human, and he wanted company, too. So we would talk, and when he made coffee, I had coffee, too. Life puts us in strange positions, but in the end, we have to live together. He continues here. After my prison sentence was fulfilled, they sent me to Dahaniya in Gaza for 2 years, end quote. Dahaniya was a town in the Gaza Strip built by Israel for informants and collaborators who, fearing retribution, could not return to their homes. Abu continues, "These were the filthiest people, scum of the earth, and I had to live there for 2 years. No one was permitted to speak to me. This was punishment for the fact that I wouldn't talk. This was far worse than any prison, and I appealed to the Supreme Court asking to be sent back to prison. But they denied my request. Your father, along with Yuri Avneri and others, protested, and I spoke against this inhumane punishment. But it did no good. I would look at the soldiers and curse them, and curse the Israeli army, but I got no response. From time to time, the authorities would come and say to me, 'You can do whatever you want. No one will speak to you here.'" He heaved a deep sigh. "I am 72 now. I will be 73 in 10 days. I am still paying for what I did back then, but I do not regret any of it. No, I am a fighter and a commander, and I devoted my life to the struggle. I did what my conscience dictated, and I was prepared to die every time I went on a mission." Then he paused, sat up, and said quietly, "We all belong to this land and need to live together. Not one Arab state and one Jewish state. Judaism is a religion, and I am speaking of a secular state of all its citizens. That is the only way to live here. Being Jewish or Muslim or Christian or atheist, that is a personal choice, not for me to dictate and not to be dictated to me. I don't want a priest or a rabbi or a sheikh to govern my life. We belong in this land, and we need to live here as equals." End quote. Almost done with the chapter here, folks. Let's continue. This was not the first time I had heard someone talk of the, quote, one secular democratic state as the right solution. It was the part of the Fatah Manifesto to create a secular democracy in all of Palestine. In the past, I could not stomach it. But the more I met impressive, intelligent people like Abu Ali, people who were driven by principle, the more I thought that there was no point, indeed no future, in dividing the people and the land. Not to mention the fact that the settlements and the facts on the ground had succeeded in erasing the West Bank as a viable area in which a Palestinian state could be established. My family were all Zionists. And so, And so was I to begin with, but cracks were forming in my conviction that there was a need or even a justification for a state that was Jewish. Then Abu Ali began speaking about my father again. I visited your father's grave 9 or 10 times, and each time I brought flowers. The last time was late in 2003. Then they took away my permit to enter Israel, so I can no longer travel outside the West Bank. At that point, one of the other guys in the room asked, Abu Ali, why did you visit the grave so many times? Wasn't General Pellet also responsible for our suffering? After all, he too was an Israeli general. Abu Ali stood up. I looked at him and thought, his small physique can be misleading because when he speaks, men far larger than he listen in silence. General Peled was no ordinary general, he said, his tone clearly reprimanding. He changed as a result of something that we saw, and he never looked back. He was a great man, and he could have been a cabinet member or even prime minister if he stayed and towed the line. But no, he followed his conscience and remained true to it his entire life. I never met him, but felt and still feel a real kinship towards him. End quote. When I got home that evening, I told my mother this story. She immediately replied, yes, I remember this. Your father was so upset he couldn't sleep for weeks. He wrote to Rabin and to Chaim Bar-Lev about it, but they did nothing. This changed him completely. I am aware of the fact that even to a minor degree, not very many people are listening online. Frankly, if anyone, I can tell by my magic box up here, who's cutting in here and causing a mark to appear on the statistics, I think it has at least in part to do with the fact of the lousy production values of trying to read this book on my personal computer from my own home, from my bedroom, as it were. I have had fleeting thoughts of, even after we do get into a real radio studio again, when Free Radio gets into a studio again, that I would read the book again from start to finish. That's not very realistic, and I know now that I will not do that. Again, before too long, all the chapters that I have read on the air, over the net, will be are being recorded and will be archived at radioforall.net. Now, there's one chapter left. Oddly and interestingly, the title of chapter 16 is One State, Two States, Three States. It's not very long, but that will have to wait until Saturday. In the meantime, I want very much to read to you something that I've been aware of for a week or two. International Radio Day. Okay, I heard a commercial by a radio company that specializes in very high-quality radio sets, very small ones and large ones, and apparently they have fantastic reception, and they included in the ad that Radio Day is coming up. Well, that was a few days ago, a week or so ago, and just today I got this. I'm on the United Nations list here for news from the UN News Center. This came today, marking World Radio Day. UN officials urge use of radio as lifeline, in quotations, lifeline in human progress. And let's pull up the main. Obviously, I have to talk about this because today, this is Radio Day, Saturday, February 13th. And this was released just yesterday, the 12th. The international community should strive to find ways for radio to do even more to help people during responses to the increasing number of emergencies and disasters facing the world, top United Nations officials said today. ahead of World Radio Day, celebrated each year on 13 February, said UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in a statement, in times of crisis and emergency, radio can be a lifeline. He added, for people in shattered societies or caught in catastrophe or desperately seeking news, radio brings life-saving information. Noting that radio can help in emergency response operations, assist with rebuilding, and give voice to local people and communities, Mr. Ban called on the international community to use the time in the lead-up to the World Humanitarian Summit in May to ensure that radio continues to improve in helping people in emergencies. The UN chief said, on this World Radio Day, let us resolve to prove that radio saves lives. This year, we can start carrying out the Sustainable Development Goals. Let us resolve to use radio for human progress. In another message for the day, Irina Bokova, the General Director of the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, emphasized that radio has demonstrated its power in situations of immediate post-disaster, but also in times of preparedness and recovery. Amidst the ruins and in the face of an emergency, the radio is often the first medium for survival, Ms. Bokova said. And she continues, its durability is an incomparable advantage, even often enabling it to resist shocks and retransmit messages of protection and prevention to as many people as possible, better and faster than other media, saving lives. End quote. Specifically, radio airs tsunami alerts in Japan and Chile and messages on how to avoid Ebola transmission in Liberia or Zika contagion in Brazil. Zika, we've all been hearing about that in recent weeks from the mosquitoes in Brazil. Continuing, the medium, which is accessible and offers real-time coverage and reporting, has the capacity to involve the audience and plays a pivotal role in preventing and mitigating disasters and the associated human costs, Ms. Bokova stressed. In 2011, the UNESCO General Conference proclaimed 13 February as World Radio Day, the day UN Radio was established in 1946, United Nations Radio, 1946. February 13, radio is the most prevalent mass medium with the ability to reach up to 95% of the world's population. As a result, World Radio Day, which this year coincides with the 70th anniversary of UN Radio, aims to celebrate radio as a medium, to improve international cooperation between broadcasters, and to encourage major networks and community radio alike to promote access to information, freedom of expression, and gender equality over the airwaves. And that is the name of that. That's the end of that news feed from the UN News Center. The UN News Service. If you go to UN.org, www.un.org, you will find how to, you will find out how to latch on to the UN News Center and their dispatches, and you will find this specific one, which includes a slideshow with featuring several aspects of World Radio Day. Well, obviously, this being Free Radio Santa Cruz meant for me that I really needed to say something about radio and what the UN says about that. I know there are a lot of people out there who are very, contemptuous of the UN because it's cool to be contemptuous of anything that represents big government. And when you're talking about government which extends over the entire planet, it's kind of automatic for people to say, oh, that's the UN, we don't want anything to do with them, we don't want them to take over our lives. But at the very least, the United Nations is talking about World Radio Day and the benefits of radio in society. 95% of the world's population has access to that medium. Okay, very long, probably longer than usual show today. I neglected to mark down the total number of minutes in the first half, but all the recordings seem to be going fine. And roughly 2 hours, about 2 hours of show, maybe a little longer or so. Please join me next Saturday when I will finish the very last chapter of Miko Peled's remarkable and very revealing book, The General's Son: Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, next Saturday, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM in the city of Santa Cruz, and streaming live all over the world, and who knows where else, maybe even to the core of this planet, streaming online at freakradio.org. Also, don't forget to join me for my Monday program, 3 p.m. on Monday, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, 1500 hours. Until then, do what you can, but behave yourself.